And so to our regular astronomy, or look at astronomy, should I say, welcome back, Jane Green. Morning, Jane.
Good morning, Tony. How are you?
I'm very well, actually. I'm enjoying sort of the occasional look up at the stars. I'm never quite sure what I'm looking at when I look up there, and you explain it so well. But I look up and see many, many stars, three stars in a line. I see something that looks like a saucepan, all sorts of bits and pieces. I wonder at it all, and then the occasional satellite flies overhead as well. But there's some wonders going on in the sky, aren't there?
There's always a lot happening up there, Tony, out there, should I say, because, of course, it's happening all around us all the time.
Yeah, one of the things that's been going on, and actually made the papers the other day. I can't find the item now, but it was to do with solar flares, and there are lots of them going on. And of course, they also take part in altering or making the atmosphere and environment or weather, really, for what we've got here on Earth, don't they?
Well, now that's a big subject you've just raised there, Tony. Yes, I think I know what you're referring to. It was NASA caught some footage of the activity on the surface of the sun, because, of course, solar flares are activity on the surface of the sun. And they caught quite a large size flare on the 30th of March, it was. Now, for any of the listeners that don't know, a flare is a tremendous explosion on the surface of the sun, often lasting really just a few minutes. But it's when the intense magnetic fields on the surface of our star become very, very tangled. And this is, it's a bit like a rubber band. And if it twists and twists and twists, which is a representation of these magnetic field lines, the more they twist, eventually there's such an enormous amount of sort of constrained energy that they snap. And when these field lines snap, they release an enormous amount of energy into space, and they heat the surrounding material to many millions of degrees. And there are different types of flares as well. But the one that the NASA captured the other day, in fact, NASA reported it, but it was the Solar Orbiter, the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter, that actually caught it. And it was what we call an X-class flare. And this is a really, really big one. It's what we'd consider like a major event. And these kind of large flares can trigger global blackouts on the surface of our planet, long-lasting radiation storms as well in the upper atmosphere. And this is what happened the other day. So, of course, you know, a lot of people got interested in it. But flares happen across the surface of the sun all the time, Tony, all the time. But of course, in the solar cycle, now this is a cycle that lasts 11 years, effectively 22 years. So for the first 11 years, the sun's activity changes. It often gets more energetic, there's a lot more activity, and then it dwindles again over a period of 22 years. That's all to do with the magnetic flipping of the sun, because the sun itself is essentially a big magnet. So it's got a north and a south polar magnet, and they flip. So it takes 11 years for them to flip south to north, and then another 11 years for them to flip back again.
So does it actually affect the climate here on Earth, though? I mean, because I know it affects things like, you know, satellite receivers and various electronic devices. But I mean, surely when you're talking about something 93 million miles away that gives the Earth its or this planet its heat, when it kicks off a solar flare, as you said, these are millions of degrees hot. Surely, yes, some of that heat must arrive at Earth and alter, you know, the climate here.
In a word, Tony, no.
Doesn't.
No. All right. Because most of the energy that's given off, most of it is given off in the range of the X-rays and the electromagnetic spectrum. And these are absorbed in the upper atmosphere. So nearly all of them are absorbed. So we're actually protected down on the surface of the planet. So it's not, there's never actually been any sufficient proof that flares do that. Because if we go back to the range of the solar cycle itself, over that 22-year cycle, so from the beginning when the sun is what we call quite quiet, so there are very few sunspots which give us an indication of activity. Now, sunspots normally mark where those flares are, or where even bigger events like coronal mass ejections that are focused. So if you basically, if you're seeing sunspots on the surface of the sun, that's where the heightened activity is. Now, as the solar cycle progresses, we get increasingly more sunspots. They migrate from the north and south poles towards the equator, and we're able to watch them crossing the face of the sun. And by after about 11 years, we get to what we call the solar maximum. That's the peak of activity. So there's a lot more sunspots, which are indicating a lot more active magnetic fields, more solar flares, more coronal mass ejections. So large ejections of mass from the surface of the sun. And it's at these times that there's a lot more energy being produced. But even so, over the whole range of those, in that 22-year cycle, the solar irradiance, as we call it, which is like the total amount of energy that is being given off, it only varies by something like 0.15%, which is actually very, very small. And it's certainly less than what would be needed to force a change in the climate that we see.
Right.
Of course, it's not just the sun that it affects our climate, of course. There's many other climatic things that are caused by Earth itself. I mean, we have El Nino, we have volcanic activity. All of those things contribute to temperature, to rainfall. So it's not just the sun. And it's often quoted, I mean, you know, I've read this myself many times, that from 1645 to 1715, we had what was known as the Maunder Minimum. You've probably heard of it.
And no, that's when you'll explain almost, it at some point, I'm sure.
Well, there were almost no sunspots recorded during that time on the surface of the sun. So it was you know, literally that was an indication that there wasn't much activity at all. But that didn't tie in with the actual climate on planet Earth at the time. Because around that time as well, we had the Little Ice Age. I can't remember the dates off the top of my head, but we had the Little Ice Age. When was that? Let me think. So, 1550 to 1850.
Oh, this is, of course, when the Thames froze over, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And that started a long time before we had the Maunder Minimum. So they didn't tie in at all. So, of course, it was a time when everything was much, much colder on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was thought that because the sun wasn't particularly active, that played its part. But the Ice Age started long before the Maunder Minimum and continued afterwards as well. So scientists haven't been able to find a sufficient tie-in with that pattern. And it just goes to show as well that these solar cycles, they don't actually indicate increased climatic changes on planet Earth, or not really. There's no actual pattern to them. So, I mean, the sun, you know, has been quite quiet for decades, and then it increases again. But it would need to be sort of consistently active for decades, in fact, perhaps centuries, to be, you know, far more active, that irradiance to be far greater, to create any kind of climatic impact on the planet itself.
Well, I mean, that kind of puts some sort of clarity to the subject and hopefully answers the question about climate.
Because
it's been
the key thing, Tony, is it's not the sun in isolation.
No.
So I think the conclusion is that over long periods of time, yes, it could certainly have an impact. And I think if we look back at tree rings and ice samples, it does show that with increased activity on the sun, there are changes on the planet itself. But it has to be over a longer period of time. And to answer your question, solar flares, which happen on the sun all the time, don't change the climate instantly and don't have a great effect. But they do affect the satellites. They would affect, because we know it actually does affect them quite greatly, if astronauts are, you know, going to be rambling around on the surface of the moon, we need to know if there's going to be increased activity on the sun, because it will affect them. The radiation certainly will do.
And of course, as we all know, the world relies on electronics and satellites these days, so
yes.
I think there'll be a keen interest in what happens with that great yellow ball in the sky and the flares that come off it in the future. But I began all of this by saying we look up in the night sky, and that's what I've been doing. And one of the things that's coming up is a conjunction of Venus and Jupiter. Couple of the planets that you can see them in the sky right now, can't you?
Yes, you can. You need to be a bit of an early riser, though, Tony.
Yeah.
Because Venus and Jupiter, well, Venus rises at the moment about 70 minutes before the Sun, with Jupiter rising 30 minutes later. So you need to be up sort of quite early in the morning.
About 3-4 o'clock, I would guess.
Yes, yes. Now, so on the 27th of April, they're just over 3 degrees apart from each other, which is 3 times the width of your thumb held at arm's length. But that distance between them is going to be decreasing and decreasing until, by the 1st of May, they'll only be 22 arc minutes apart from each other, which is about a third of the width of your thumb held at arm's length.
What is an arc minute?
Close. Sorry?
Say, what is an arc minute? We talk about light years. You've just lobbed into the thing. Arc minutes. I'm presuming they go some way to making up the amount of light years, I presume.
Well, no, they're literally just distance measurements against the sky. Mm-hmm. So your thumb measures 1 degree across, and inside 1 degree is 60 minutes.
Ah, right.
Okay, so then if you split your thumb into 60, then Venus and Jupiter will be 22 of those minutes apart from each other.
Not far.
It's literally not far at all. It's literally about a third the width of your thumb held at arm's length. So if you hold your thumb up to the sky, the distance of a third the width of your thumb, that will be the distance between Venus and Jupiter in the morning sky. Wow. So stunning. I mean, that's very, very close. So they'll be the closest that they're going to be on the 1st of May. So if you've got a pair of binoculars, take a look. You'll be able to see the 4 largest moons circling Jupiter. I mean, Jupiter has 79 moons, but the 4 largest ones, the ones we call the Galilean moons, are visible in binoculars. So if you have some, take a look. If you have a telescope, even better.
Well, we'll see what we can do with that one, but that one's in the early hours of the morning.
Yes.
One of the things that is probably one of the most spectacular things that anybody can see going on in the sky, apart from the Northern Lights, which is probably a similar thing, but just much, much closer, I guess, is the meteor showers. And I'm told there are some what's known as Lyrid meteor showers coming our way soon.
Yes, the Lyrid meteor showers.
Or Lyrid.
The Lyrids, yes. So for anyone who doesn't know what a meteor shower is, it's a shower of shooting stars, because a shooting star is also known as a meteor. And if that piece, that object, lands on the surface of the planet, it's called a meteorite. So a meteor is a shooting star. Now, as Earth travels around the Sun, it's being hit by material from space all the time. So this can be dust-sized particles to pebbles to rocks to sometimes much, much bigger than that. And of course, you know, they can cause global damage. But that we are being slammed all the time throughout the year, which is why every time you step out at night, you can see shooting stars. You'll see more after midnight than before midnight. But if you look up for a sufficient period of time, you're bound to see shooting stars, so streaks of light across the sky. And that's these tiny particles and bigger particles burning up, vaporizing in the Earth's upper atmosphere. Now, as Earth travels around the Sun throughout the year, it passes through the tails of comets, which have been passing around the Sun and going back out beyond the solar system. So we're being hit by things, surrounded by things, circling the Sun for many, many, many years, millions of years actually. And as comets pass around the Sun, so these are large chunks of rock and ice that have come from the outer reaches of the solar system and beyond. As they approach the Sun, they melt and they create those glorious tails that we see, gas tails and dust tails. They pass around the Sun. Mostly they make it around the Sun. Sometimes they don't. They're swallowed up by the Sun's gravity. But they'll pass around the Sun and they'll go back out to where they started and sort of keep looping round. But they leave their trail behind them of dust and gas.
Okay.
And as Earth travels around the Sun periodically at predictable times, we pass through the leftover tails of these comets. And of course, as we're passing through, that means there's a lot more dust and debris out there, a lot more material slamming into the atmosphere, creating a lot more shooting stars, and that's what we call meteor showers. And we've got one of those peaking this month on the night of the 22nd of April.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not what we call a really active meteor shower. There are other meteor showers throughout the year where you can expect to see a lot more shooting stars per hour. Sometimes it can be at least 100 per hour, which is actually very, very high. This is one of sort of the quieter ones, but this is a legacy of comets G1 Thatcher. So that's one that passed through some time ago. But you will definitely see more shooting stars that night. So you need to be stepping outside, wrap up warm, and look towards the constellation of Lyra, which is in it's near the star Vega in the constellation of Lyra. So if you're not sure where that is, it's quite hard to describe on the radio. Just look it up. Google the constellation Lyra, L-Y-R-A, and that's where you need to be looking, because that's where the shooting stars will appear to emanate from. But of course, really, they're going to be all over the sky, so just keep looking.
Yeah, well, we've mentioned Venus and Jupiter. Mars normally comes into the conversation, but not today. The other planet that's coming into focus a bit later this month, I do believe, is Saturn, along with a crescent moon. Should be a spectacular sight, I would have thought.
It will be. Again, you need to be up a bit earlier in the morning. But on the 24th, so the morning of the 25th, you'll see a waning crescent moon. So that's the moon where the light is actually sort of diminishing across it. So it's a decreasing brightness of the moon.
Yeah.
If you find the crescent moon, easy to find. If you just look to the lower right, it'll be about a fist's width away. You'll see Saturn. You'll also see the red planet Mars, and still there will be Venus and Jupiter.
See, Mars couldn't keep out of the story, could it, really?
No. So you're going to see a beautiful crescent moon and four planets all sort of clustering together.
Yeah, definitely some things to see in the sky over the next few weeks. But of course, as we head towards the lighter months, of course, it's not quite. I mean, you'd have thought it would have been good in the middle of the night, but even in the middle of the night, as we approach summer, it's not going to be quite so good, because the hours of darkness, effectively, are very, very short, aren't they?
Yes, they're very short, and the sun never really dips that far below the horizon.
Yeah.
So, as you say, Tony, it never really gets lovely and dark as it does in the winter. So we don't really like the summer for stargazing. It's nice and warm, but there's not quite as much to see. Although, having said that, Tony, we've got a total lunar eclipse coming up next month.
Oh.
And as the months go by, the Milky Way becomes beautiful, because, you know, we're looking in a different direction towards the centre, or we're always looking away from it throughout the year. And it can be very, very beautiful in the months of August going into September.
Well, they're all things to talk about, and I'm looking forward to finding out about this eclipse that you mentioned there in a month's time when we talk again. But, Jane, as always, never enough time. We've run well over time. For now. So thank you for talking to us this morning. And Jane Green, we'll catch up with you in a month's time. Thank you.
Thank you.